Greetings, crew. This is your Nav speaking. It's Thursday, April 5th, 2012. And here I am at my post on the navigation deck in Andalusia. It's about 3 in the morning, a lovely winter evening, not too cool. The waxing moon is over the house with Mars off to the right. Some clouds in the sky and some stars twinkling through. It's a calm night on the navigation deck. A couple of cats zonked out in here on the daybed. And I'm recording Navigator Briefing number 7, which is entitled Divine Alchemy. Correction, that would be Navigator Briefing number 6. I have a little difficulty keeping up with these things. Purpose of this briefing is to recapitulate some events that have happened over the past 2 months, going back to February, and moving ahead, actually until September of this year. You might recall that in February, there was a perigee hit, one of three in the constellation of the Virgin. The succession of these hits is as follows. February 11th, which was in 13 Libra, roughly the upper chest or thymus of the Virgin. March 10th, in 17 Libra, we could say in the womb or solar plexus, the tummy of the Virgin. And coming up in 2 days, April 7th, a perigee hit in 1 Scorpio, which is in the knees of the Virgin. Now, when the first hit was due, I proposed a particular syntax to describe the series of events we might associate with this sequence. And in doing so, I introduced three terms. The first was reticulation. The second term was metabolism. And the third term was articulation. So if you recall, the impact of the first hit of February 11th was felt in the nervous system and in by the escalation of the reticulation of myelin, of the myelin sheaths of the nervous system, and also to some extent parts of the brain. But not all parts of the brain are sheathed in myelin. Some are unsheathed. So at that time, I proposed that we were looking at an event, the first in a sequence of events, that involve divine alchemy. Divine alchemy being the theme for the lunar perigee, divine memory being the theme for the lunar apogee. We've been engaging in this practice for a while now, and so some of you, I think, will be comfortable with the concept that the Aeon Sophia, who is the living intelligence of the earth, can actually impact our anatomy and our neurochemical, physiological, biological, and metabolic makeup. She can actually do this by simply directing her attention to us with a particular intention. So the perigee hits might be correlated, they are correlated very closely to Sophia's use of the first attention And our role in her alchemy is simply to know what she's doing and when, and to participate in it as consciously as we can. Also, our role is to understand the designs and purposes of her, of the actions that she's taking in this respect. You might recall that there was quite a complex picture built up around the February 11th hit. We had to consider a number of things. It was a massive event. It came on very strong at the time. Some of you may be still feeling effects from it. I pointed out at that time that due to the earth changes currently happening, and due also to the escalation of psychopathic behaviors and to the manta signals that are exciting the psychopaths to the absolute limit of their murderous rage and deceit, that we all need some protection, and that protection comes inside the body itself. Your nervous system is protected by the myelin sheath. We know that the February 11th hit indicated that Sophia is reticulating myelin at a fantastic rate, providing us with the protection of our nervous system so that we don't burn out under the intensity of what is coming our way. There are many ways to look at this. I do believe that the solar activity, the mass coronal emissions, producing an excitation in the electromagnetic field of the Earth, are indeed stressing the nervous system that we have operating, our operating system, not the OS, but the NOS, the nervous operating system. And we need more insulation in order to handle the higher charge and the turbulent conditions in the electromagnetic field. So this is what's happening since February with the boost or escalation of the reticulation of myelin. And I want to point out, again, just in case you're not 100% certain, the ritual of the carnal embrace does not cause the escalation of building the myelin sheaths. That the cause of that event comes from the earth itself. It's a ritual of reciprocation. It's simply a ritual that we undertake in order to optimize the conditions of intense but tender attendance in which this reticulation can unfold. Intense and tender holding in the carnal embrace. Soft, sweet, intense, tender holding is a way of attending to the process that we cannot actually see. You have the syntax of this process, and you also have, to put it in conventional terms, simply a description of the reticulation of myelin. You have a description of it, a medical description, if you will. You know this is happening in your body, just as you know that the enzymes in your stomach are digesting your meal several hours after you've eaten. Just as you know what the lobes in your lungs are doing, what the chambers of your heart are doing right now with the systole and diastole of your heartbeat. You know that. You are a creature able to know things about its own physiological, metabolic, and anatomical functions. So the ritual of the carnal embrace is a ritual of attending to a very special event. It facilitates and augments the process of reticulation. Now, when I proposed that ritual, which came to me spontaneously in the rush of the dreaming attention, it occurred to me that I might also propose two other rituals for the other perigee hits in this sequence. But of course, as you know, everything that happens in the Gaia Navigation Experiment and Planetary Tantra happens spontaneously. It's not programmatic. Now, a month after February 11th, we came to March 10th, coming up on the first anniversary of correction. And there was a perigee hit in 1718 Libra, which is in the upper belly of the Virgin, the upper belly region. And I correlated that to metabolism. The third hit coming up on Saturday is in 1 degree Scorpio in the knees of the Virgin, and I correlated that to articulation. So we have this trilogy of terms, reticulation, metabolism, and articulation. I think that I elaborated a bit on this trilogy in a previous talk. I believe, if I recall, I pointed out that we could rewrite biology and physiology and base it entirely on these three terms. You know, I have a book in my library. It's a very thick 800-page book on human anatomy and physiology that is used by medical students, first-year medical students, and I guess it's a standard text if you're going to go to medical school to learn to become a nurse, to train to become a nurse or a doctor and so forth. This book describes all parts of the human anatomy from the brain down to the reproductive organs, the digestive organs, everything you can think of. And it has a series of questions and answers at the end of each chapter, which supposedly, which I presume are the questions and answers that you would be facing if you're taking an exam in college. This is a terrible book. It's so full of technical jargon and excruciating detail and complex terminology that, frankly, I can't imagine seriously how any person could be expected to master even a part of this. No wonder medicine has become very specialized. If this is what a medical student has to learn, then I, you know, send my compassion out to medical students. It's to me, it's inconceivable that even an extremely diligent and intelligent person could master the terms. The problem with the whole presentation of the human organism in this book is typical of the problem of our sciences today, whether it be astronomy, botany, or medicine. That is the overwhelming complexity of the terms, the terminology, and the complexity of the information, which is far exceeds any single person's capacity to take on board. Well, I'm absolutely convinced in a more simple approach to the phenomenon of nature, the phenomena of nature and of human existence, of human anatomy, physiology, and metabolism, that by Gurdian method, I mean something based on observation. By Gurdian method, I mean morphologically determined science. That is, science that looks at the morphology of things and observes the morphology and does not invent systems and terms and complex terms relating to other terms and variations of those terms. So I'm really confident that with these three terms, you could found a whole science of nature. Give you an example, just to look at the brain. In the brain, we see, according to this medical text that I own, we see hundreds and hundreds of particular details, functions, and junctions, and processes, and so on. When I look at the brain, I only see three things. I see the reticulation of the brain. That is the sheathing of the nerve fibers of the brain, the axon and the dendron structures. And I see that these are sheathed structures. So I see the reticulation. Reticulation is the sheathing or the encasing, if you will. Reticulation is also evident in the formation of any cell. Any cell is an enclosed, it's a porous, it's a structure composed of a porous, electrically charged, electrically conductive membrane. A porous, electively conductive membrane determines the boundaries of a cell. Because the cell has boundaries, it can operate autonomously and then also in interaction with other cells. So the formation of cells is an act of reticulation. When I look at the brain again, I see metabolism. What is that? Metabolism is the operation of the neurochemical transmitters and the way that they function in the transfer of electrical charges from axon to dendron, the jumping across the synapses. That's the metabolism of the brain. The metabolism of the brain is a massive thunderbolt aggregate of electrical charges. It's like a storm cloud, a cloud with electrical charges flashing in it. That's the metabolism of the brain, an electrochemical discharge process. And then there's the articulation of the brain. And that is, of course, its different parts. The frontal lobes, the back brain, the corpus callosum, the different distinguishable organs within the brain, which are connected with memory, which are connected with fight or flight, the brain stem, the medulla oblongata, the pineal gland, the cerebral globes. What is this? This is all the articulation of the brain. Now, turn your gaze from the picture, the image of the brain, to a tree. What do you see when you see a tree? You see the reticulation of the tree, which is the bark. This is the layers of the bark and the bark around the limbs, not only the bark around the trunk. That's reticulation. Saw the trunk, cut the trunk, and look at the rings. Those are the rings of reticulation of the tree. Follow the shape of the tree out to the branches. Each branch has a thin bark around it. That is the reticulation of the branches. You see the reticulation of the tree. Then look at the metabolism. What is the metabolism of the tree? It's the circulation of the sap up and down through the trunk, out to the limbs. It's the interaction of the tree with light and air and chemicals in the soil, something that the alchemists understood very deeply. Photosynthesis is the metabolism of the tree. Finally, what is the articulation of the tree? Articulation of the tree is the branches that articulate into smaller branches, which articulate into leaf systems. The leaf systems are reticulated because they have a particular surface. And when you look at the pattern on a leaf, you see the channels of the leaf. You see the beautiful patterning of the leaf, and that is an articulation within the reticulation of the leaf. And then the leaf itself is an instrument of metabolism because it collects rain, it collects sunlight, it gives shade, it's totally interactive. And then you see the fruits, then you see the blossoms of the tree, that is more articulation. Then you see the fruits of the tree, more articulation. But within each fruit is a seed. What is the seed? That is reticulation, because the seed is a contained or reticulated compacted unit. If the seed were not reticulated, then it could not be protected so that it can survive and root itself in another environment. So as far as I'm concerned, Goethe had the whole thing down. Goethe had the whole method of science down. And what I'm proposing in these three terms, in this threefold syntax, is that we use this method of science for a Goethean / Gaian observation of nature, including an observation of our own minds and bodies. That's what I'm suggesting. Okay, so to pick up the sequence we're following, there are two hits so far behind us. I'm speaking on April 5th, 2012. The second hit on March 10th, I associated with metabolism, and the upcoming hit with articulation. Now, the ritual of the carnal embrace came up spontaneously, as I said. So far as I know, I didn't. Some crew members wrote in suggesting things that they felt happening to them during the March 10th, around the March 10th hit, connect that might be considered as the ritualistic counterparts to that event. I myself didn't get any particular ritual at that time. I sort of did, but it came spontaneously. It wasn't something that I thought about. It was something that I found myself doing. You know, it's as if you were sitting one day in your house in the afternoon, just relaxing, and you found yourself, rubbing the bottom of your chin with the top of your right hand. I mean, just imagine that. If you were just sitting there and suddenly you were holding up your hand flat with the palm down, and you were rubbing the upper part of your hand slowly back and forth across the underneath your chin. And you just spontaneously did that. You know, there is a term for that. That kind of phenomena is not unknown. That kind of behavior is not unknown. It used to be called, it used to be observed back in the 70s and 80s among people who hung out with these Indian gurus such as Muktananda and so forth. In fact, I had a girlfriend in L.A. who used to go see Muktananda quite a lot in the last years when he was out and about. And many people around Muktananda experienced Shaktipat, which is said to be the spontaneous arousal of kundalini shakti when you're in the presence of a master. And this girlfriend of mine, who used to be an actress in Hollywood and a model, told me that she had Shaktipat in audience with Muktananda, as many other people did. And she also had it at other times as well. For instance, when she told me once that she was on an airplane and she had Shaktipat, which was a little bit odd because she was sitting there in the seat beside one or two other people, whatever. And as a result of the Shaktipat, which is a spontaneous and irrepressible upsurge of erotic force out of the body, she started to spontaneously do mudras, which are like hand gestures. And so there she was sitting on the airplane making these mudras with her hands and writhing, although the degree that to which she could writhe, to which her torso could writhe, which happens with Shaktipat, was determined by the constrictions of the airplane seat. But to get to the point of this anecdote, when people have Shaktipat, they also often make spontaneous mudras. Well, we are getting Shaktipat from Gaya Sophia. This is a fact. And particularly in reference to this second hit, I felt a kind of reaction of the type that I'm describing here from this this old L.A. anecdote. I felt myself making certain gestures. One of the gestures I made was that I would take my right hand and I would cluster together the four fingers of my right hand, bring the points of the four fingers together and bend them. And then I would take my thumb and I would bring my thumb right down into the area, the little semicircle that is defined by the four fingers of my hand being clustered together at the tips. And I would bring my thumb right down into there, but I wouldn't allow it to touch any of the fingers. And I would look at that, and I would just look at it, hold it up and look at it right in front of my eyes. And I would consider that it was a sparking gap, like you find on a spark plug. There's a spark gap. So there was a spark gap between my thumb and the four conjoined fingertips. And then I would bring the thumb very, very close to those fingertips and look at it. Look at my hand right in front of me, front and center. And then I would bring my hand very slowly down to my side, hold it down, and I would very slowly open my hand. Open my hand so that the fingers separated and the thumb pulled away. And just open, 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 open my hand until I have an open palm with all fingers separated and the thumb loose, relaxed, an open, relaxed palm. And then I would very slowly reverse the motion and do the same thing over again, very slowly. If you want to try it, go ahead. See if you can do it and see if you can take 2 minutes to bring your hand into that mudra and 2 minutes to release it into an open, relaxed hand. Or if you can take 5 minutes or 10 minutes. Imagine how slow you would have to do it if you took 10 minutes to do it. The point of this spontaneous mudra is that it is a kind of ritual that may be used to tell your mind, your first attention, that you are attending to the heightened metabolism of ATP in your ribosomes. The heightened metabolism of ATP in your ribosomes. Because that is the effect of the March 10th hit in 17, 18 degrees of Libra. Now, normally in our normal state of awareness, in our day-to-day consciousness, you know, we have a nice arrangement, folks. You know, it's often been observed that your body doesn't bother you with telling you what it's doing until it needs your attention because something is not working correctly. So normally you don't feel your heart, you don't feel the diastole and systole of your heart, you don't feel the blood flushing through the various four chambers, you don't feel it surging through the right ventricle, the left ventricle, and so forth and so on. Because if you do, either in a heightened state of awareness where every single minute sensation of your physiological and metabolic functions become conscious, and I wouldn't wish that on anyone because I've had it and it's difficult to sustain and endure. Well, we don't normally live like that, and we're not supposed to. Normally, the body functions without letting us know how it does so. So it's normal that even the massive escalation of the metabolism of ATP in the ribosomes would remain undetected in certain ways. But our process in Sophia's correction is to bring our attention to what she's doing, whether it be in the atmosphere, in the planetary body of the Earth, or in our own bodies. We want to attend consciously to what she's doing. And so by this hand exercise is one possible example. You could devise your own, or maybe you have spontaneously discovered your own exercise over the last month. But I assure you that if you do this exercise with your hand, while at the same time suggesting to yourself, because it is a process of auto-suggestion or an autogenic biofeedback process. If you do it in an autogenic manner, you will, in effect, be connecting your first attention, which is not normally connected with the intimate processes of your metabolism, with those intimate processes. So what I suggest to my mind as I do this exercise of contracting and expanding my hand very, very slowly. And by the way, don't let your hand get tense when you do it. Avoid tension. Just do it in a slow, relaxed way, almost as if you're doing it casually. In fact, you can kind of do it on the side. Hold your hand off on the side and do it as if you're not really even paying attention. Like, be real casual about it. Do not do it in a stressful or tense manner. If you do this, I guarantee you that that act of attending will connect you with Sophia's activity of her first attention as it is operating on your body and in your body. This is a practice of planetary tantra. So as I say, that was a spontaneous mudra that came to me, and others may have come to you, and others will be just as good as mine if you practice them, and if you bring the right kind of attending to them. If you attend correctly, they will be just as good. So much for the factor of metabolism. Now, what we have coming up in 2 days on April 7th is a third perigee hit around 1 degrees of Scorpio in the sign zodiac. That would be about 211 degrees of the ecliptic. And in the real sky constellations, that places the perigee hit right at the knees of the Virgin. Bear in mind that the Virgin is the largest constellation of the 13 zodiacal constellations on the path of the Earth. It is 45 to 48 degrees in extent. The Sun or the Earth, as you will, stays in that constellation for 1/8 of each entire year. And even though the Virgin is the most massive constellation on the path of the ecliptic, it would be even more massive if she was standing up, but she's not, she's kneeling. So this point, 1 degree of Scorpio, is at her knees, and the star Lambda Virginis, called Cambalia, is located in 8 degrees of Scorpio, about 7 degrees further along the zodiac. And this star, Cambalia, which is called the Alchemist star, defines technically, visually, and graphically, and also mythographically, the extreme limit of the constellation of the Virgin before we pass into the constellation of the Balance or Scales. So 8 degrees of Scorpio, the minute star Lambda Virginis, marks the limit of the Virgin. It is beneath her knees. The April 7th hit is at her knees. Lambda Virginis is beneath her knees. And that star is called the Alchemist star for reasons which may yet to be discovered. Now, a little beyond the halfway point of this talk, and what I'd like to do in the remainder is to look ahead to April 7th and the upcoming perigee hit. Following the Trinitarian formula, or the simple trilogy I'm proposing, you could call it a trinity of Gertian morphology if you want to get fancy about it. Read Goethe, by the way. Read Goethe's Metamorphosis of Plants, and you'll understand what this idea of morphological perception is. Let's look ahead at this upcoming hit. It's in the knees of the Virgin. It has something to do with articulation. Well, we've had a hit in reticulation. That's pretty clear what that is. That was explicit. And that was a real whammy. We had a hit in metabolism. I proposed that the previous hit of March 10th represented a massive amplification of the production of ATP. And yet I haven't said anything about the April 7th hit, which in some manner or other is related to the phenomena and morphology of articulation. So what could I say about that? Well, truth be told, I don't really know what to say right now. It's like I'll be there in real time along with the rest of you, and we can find out what's happening when it happens. I mean, this is part of the beauty and spontaneity of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, or of Planetary Tantra, of which this experiment is a subset, as it were. So I don't know. I can't imagine what it's going to be. I mean, what is the articulation of your body compared to the reticulation and the metabolism? Well, let's step back and take a look at it here. Well, The reticulation of your body is evident in the insulation of your whole autonomic nervous system, your sympathetic and parasympathetic, and really go and learn all about that, folks, by reading The Function of the Orgasm by Wilhelm Reich. It's the sheathing of your nervous system and the very sheathing of your body, the sheathing of your skin, the sheathing of your eyeballs, the sheathing of your hairs, of your head, which are reticulated fibers, okay? Great. You got that picture. Your metabolism is your breathing, your blood, your lymphatic system, your sexual glandular functions, your hormonal functions, your interaction with the environment, your interaction with the atmosphere, with the components of the atmosphere, which are oxygen, nitrogen, carbon dioxide, and argon. That's your metabolism. And the deepest part of your metabolism is the production of adenosine triphosphate by the ribosomes in your cells. Okay. So far, so clear. So continuing in that vein and jamming, to use the jazz, improvised jazz term, or progressive jazz, as it used to be called, speaking in the spirit of progressive jazz, let's jam on to the mode of articulation. Well, what's that going to be? Well, I don't have the faintest idea. I mean, what is the articulation of your body? I think that it might be approached in this way. This is just one vector. I can think of several vectors. Let me offer one. Going back to the analogy of the tree, you see the reticulation of the tree. You see the metabolism of the tree, and you see the articulation of the tree. And the articulation of the tree is most gloriously manifest in the budding and flowering and fruiting. Now look at what a bud is. Look at an apple, budding apple tree, and go right up there and stick your face in it. Your face in the boughs of a budding apple tree and smell that aroma and look at those buds, and each one of those buds is a reticulated unit. It's a globular unit. It's reticulated, and when that bud bursts open, then the fruit bursts out of that bud. The apple grows, and the apple is a reticulated entity. It has the skin, which is its reticulation. It has its inner flesh of the apple with its juices and its chemistry and its nutrition, which is the metabolism of the apple. And the whole process of the budding and fruiting of the apple is the articulation of the tree. So we're going to have a hit in articulation. What is that going to mean? What is that going to mean? I would guess that the articulation of the human organism is the fruiting and flowering of the organism. Well, what's that? Well, it suggests something sexual, of course, but of course we have to stay away from reproduction here, because that's not sexual reproduction in the human species is not Gaia's way. So it's, while we might expect a heightening and amplification of sexuality, I don't know how we're going to handle that. I can barely handle what's on board right now. But we might expect that as an aspect of articulation. We might expect something in the sexual area to blossom and birth forth in a non-reproductive manner. Possible. But what I detect even more strongly is that the blossoming and bursting forth of a fruit would be in the sensorial modalities of the human organism. The sense organs themselves are the fruiting, are the flowering and fruiting parts of the human body, aren't they? The sense organs, seeing, hearing, smelling, taste, and touch. These five sense organs, and there are others as well, these five sense organs are where the human body blossoms and fruits. So I would suggest that the hit will be delivered there and that the effects of the hit will be detected there. That's what I suggest. So in conclusion, and staying in the vein of this third theme of articulation, I'd like to describe a dream that I had when I was about 16 years old. And I've shared my dreams before. You know about the dream of the hag on the roof when I was 4 years old. And this was a lucid dream. These are all lucid dreams. These are three lucid dreams of the Turton. The dream of the hag on the roof at the age of four. The dream of Mantis enthroned in a lemon quartz crystal at the center of the earth at the age of 26 or so. And this is a dream I had around the age of 16. I'm going to recount this dream simply so that you have a reference to the upcoming hit of the first attention. And so that you have a reference to this fascinating concept of articulation. I call this the dream of the green man. This is only a second time, only the second time I've shared this dream. I did also share this dream before a group of people in Marion, Massachusetts in 1999 when I first presented a talk there along with Graham Hancock. And I, at that time, described this dream to the people attending at the Marion conference. Bear in mind that when I was about 16, I had a series of Kundalini experiences, spontaneous awakening of Kundalini that were terrifying to me at the time. And they occurred, they began, they were triggered, as it were, by a series of lucid dreams that I had. My situation at that time as a 15, 16-year-old boy living in a small town in Maine was pretty terrifying because it's something like a theme that comes up in these teenage horror movies like Nightmare on Elm Street and Halloween and so forth. I was terrified to go to sleep over a period of a winter and spring. Terrified to go to sleep because when I went to sleep, I would have a lucid dream, and in this lucid dream, I would have a spontaneous attack of Kundalini. And this spontaneous attack of Kundalini paralyzed me and did not allow me to breathe or move. And so I thought I was going to die. And so it was all pretty frightening to me. And this went on for 6 months, you know, more or less once or twice a week. But eventually, while I did survive, obviously, and eventually, the series of dreams, lucid dreams with electrical discharge of Kundalini resolved itself. The series of dreams resolved into a single dream. And this is a scenario of that dream, which was lucid. I was sitting in some kind of castle, a very elegant surrounding, at a dinner party. And I knew that I was in a place of very high privilege. Later on in life, I came to associate this with the company of the Grail, or the Grail Castle. But at that time, when I was 16 or so, I didn't really have that terminology. I just knew that I was in a place of privilege and in the domain of the nobility, whoever the nobility were. And I felt rather embarrassed and a bit shamed that I was in the presence of nobility, and that I was this country kid from coastal Maine, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing there. I was sitting at this long table. It was about 20 feet long, 4 feet across, and I was sitting down toward one end of the table. Let's say if you're looking down at the table, I would be sitting in the forefront, and on the other side of the table was a line of people, and on my side there were maybe 8 or 10 people to my right and 2 or 3 people to my left. And so here I am, jammed in with these people at this elegant, in this elegant place. The table was covered with a white cloth. There was elaborate cutlery and dishes on the table and candelabras, and it was a setting for a great feast. And when I first became conscious in the dream, and when the dream first materialized for me, I was immediately aware that there was some conversation around me, but it was a kind of a hushed conversation. There was a mood of respect, a mood of anticipation in the room. And I was sitting there kind of slightly huddled down. I think I had my hands in my lap and my head was kind of down, and I was looking around a bit sheepishly and meekly, thinking, you know, what the hell am I doing here? And do I belong here? And who are these people who are elegantly dressed in kind of togas and robes? And I guess there was some dining going on, or I don't remember. I didn't eat anything. I don't remember anyone eating, but we all had plates in front of us. And within a matter of seconds, after becoming aware that I was having a dream, which is to say, becoming aware that I was awake in the dream, which was just as real to me as anything real, a hush fell over the room. And it was as if everyone caught their breath. And I'm like thinking, whoa, I mean, whoa, something is happening here. What is this? I didn't have time. It happened very fast. I'd say the whole dream took less than 30 seconds. As soon as I became aware in the dream, in this elegant dining hall, the atmosphere changed. And I was aware that people were looking at me. I was sort of, my eyes were sort of flitting around looking at people, but I didn't focus on anything until I heard something or felt something, and I looked off to my right. Now, off to my right was up to the end of the table, because I was seated down at one end of the table, and off to my right were 6 or 8 people. So the larger end of the table was off to my right. I looked off to my right, kind of out of the corner of my eye, shyly and reticently. And what I saw was a woman's feet. And I realized with shock that the woman who had been sitting at the head of the table to my right was now standing on the table. Now, I don't know what happened to what was on the table. Maybe there were candelabras, maybe there were not. The room was lit by candlelight, by torches. Or the decanters, or the plates, or the silverware, I don't know. All I know is that I became, 5 seconds into the dream, I became vividly aware that a woman in bare feet was walking on the table. Well, I looked at her feet, her beautiful, beautiful feet. And I watched her slowly lift one foot and put it in front of the other. The robe that she was wearing was parted in the middle. I don't know how far up her legs the part went. I didn't look up. I just saw that the part fell above her ankles so that I could see her feet, and they were like golden. Her body was like an amber body. And her feet were stepping toward me right down the center of the table. And at that point I became aware that everyone was very, very still, including myself. And all I could really do was watch her feet approaching. And she walked right down the center of the table, very, very slowly, on her bare feet, until she came to exactly in front of me, and then she turned and faced me. So I'm looking down at the beautiful feet of this woman with a white silk robe, like an ivory white silk robe flowing around her on the table, on the surface of the table, because her robe was draping on the table. And at that point, I was in shock and breathless and holding my breath, but something compelled me to look up. So my eyes slowly went up, my gaze slowly went up, the length of her body, tracing up that long, long slit in her gown, all the way up to her knees, to her hips, up to the point where the toga was drawn by a cord around her waist, and up and up, and I looked up at her. Young boy of 16, sitting at the table, looking up at this blonde, golden-haired, ambered woman. And what did I see? Well, she had her hands one above the other, clasped to the handle of a dagger. And she held this dagger between her breasts. And she held it in that position very steadily and with purpose. And she looked down at me over the butt of this dagger until our eyes met. And the moment that our eyes met, the rest of the dream unfolded, which was probably in 5 seconds or less. The moment that our eyes met, she drove that dagger straight down into the table right in front of me, no more than a foot away from my face. And the dagger hit the table and sunk into the wood of the table with a loud thunk. And at the moment that happened, I was plummeted out of that place, out of that room, that setting. And I found myself in an absolute cube of total blackness. I don't know how big this cube was. It could have been not much bigger than the dimensions of a telephone booth. It could have been much bigger. It could have been the size of a room. I cannot judge, but I was in a cube of absolute blackness. And I was on my knees, and I was breathing very, very hard because the impact of that dagger into the table had hit me in the chest like a blow. And I was on my knees, and I was aware that I had to be on my knees, and I was still looking up. I was in the typical posture of a supplicant, of someone who is brought to the knees by the awesome power of a revelation, of an epiphany. And I was on my knees in this black space looking up. And in front of me, in front of my eyes, appeared this man, a figure of a man. And it was a man of human anatomy. And he was green. And I remember that I thought immediately, even in the dream, even in the context of the dream, I thought of Prel shampoo. Because Prel shampoo used to be sold in these flexible containers, like plastic containers that you would squeeze, and it was a green gel. And this male figure was made of the same kind of dark green gel as Prel shampoo. And it was like an embryonic figure. It was not like a real man. It was more like the ideal prototype of a man. It was like the model of a man's body. And it was in a certain posture where it had one hand down and one hand up, as it seemed to be gesturing something. And its legs were slightly spread and its body was twisted. I remember exactly what it looked like. And I was stunned and riveted by the absolutely vivid appearance of this human anatomical man made of transparent green gel. And as I looked at it, and as my whole consciousness remained riveted upon this figure, I saw within the mass of its body, I saw within the gel, first in the area of the heart, a budding or explosion of a blossom in the area of the heart, like the fast frame explosion of a blossom of a tree, of a bud of a flower exploding into a blossom. And then I saw that blossoming explosion articulated itself into a filigree of leaves and veins that ran all through the body of this green man. And then I woke up. That is to say, I woke up in my bed. I was already awake. But the entire scene disappeared in a microsecond. The moment that this leafing, budding articulation of filigree veins filled the entire body of the gel man, I woke in my bed. So what I saw in that dream was a vision of articulation. Does that have anything to do with what's coming up on Saturday? I don't know. But I feel compelled to relate that dream to you. At this time, the Turton has had 3 decisive dreams, among many. The hag on the roof, Mantis at the core of the earth, and the dream of the green man. And in retrospect, it seems very clear to me that these 3 dreams were premonitions of correction. So I leave you with that dream, and I just want to point out a little footnote to that whole scenario. Sometime in the late 90s, when I was writing the first draft of Not in His Image, I read Slanted Truths by Lynn Margulis. And I found in this book, it's a collection of essays on Gaian theory and biology, and I found in this book a figure, an illustration, which is figure 10.1. And it's from a quasi-alchemical text that was printed in 1664 called Oceanus Macro Microcosmos. And it was written by Sax von Leuenheim, who was a Northern European alchemist and scientist in that period of the transition from alchemy to science. And the frontispiece of this book, Oceanus Macro Microcosmos, shows the green man of my dream. So you'll find, in connection with Crew Notes 18, that I've included a JPG file, an illustration, and if you click on it, you'll see this image. It's remarkable that when I was researching Gaian theory, the Gaia hypothesis of Margulis and Lovelock in the late 90s, that this image came to me and immediately reminded me of my dream. And now, again, some 13 years later, 14, 15 years later, the image comes back. This is an image of the articulation of the mutation and transmutation of the human organism by divine alchemy. And I would just close with what I wrote in some notes on the Gaia Sapiens Exchange. By the way, that's the first terma that I received, the proto-terma that I received upon observation of the organic light in Arc, France, in May 2000. In some notes, I refer to this image, and I wrote these comments. This image is reproduced in Slanted Truths by Lynn Margulis, and she writes, "This illustration stresses the analogies between the circulation of the blood and the circulation of water, period. Of course, the idea of macro-microcosmos is alchemical, as above, so below, as without, so within. And that is the notion that everything that exists in the natural world outside us and in the cosmos at large also exists and functions correlatively in the human body." And in my notes, I wrote, quote, In Gaian alchemy, the correspondences to be discovered between body-mind and nature are functional and not merely symbolic. Hence, they are not considered to be analogies, but actual exchanges. End quote.